It's Friday, September 30th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Coming up, the Philippines may halt joint military exercises with the United States.
60,000 plus commuters travel both ways every day to the city, and this happened right at rush hour.
A deadly commuter train accident in New Jersey. Also ahead, calls to help the wounded in Syria. Could families of 9/11 victims sue a foreign government? And a group of peculiar children. In the movies, that is. It's all on today's International Edition. Philippines President Rodrigo Duterte is again stirring controversy. During a state visit to Vietnam Wednesday, he announced that, after a joint amphibious landing exercise involving nearly 2,000 Filipino and U.S. troops next week, there will be no more under his administration.
So I'm serving notice now to the Americans and to those who rally. I will maintain the military alliance because there is an RPUS pact which our country signed in the early 50s. But I will establish new alliances for trade and commerce. And you are scheduled to hold war games again, which China does not want. I would serve notice to you now that this will be the last military exercise. Jointly, Philippines, U.S., the last one.
However, Mr. Duterte said he will maintain the military alliance with Washington that dates to the 1950s. A U.S. spokesman says the United States is prepared to continue working with Manila in areas of mutual interest, such as counterterrorism. Mr. Duterte earlier said he would end the presence of U.S. special forces providing assistance to Philippine troops fighting Muslim insurgents in the south. The Philippine leader has also indicated that he plans to open alliances in trade and commerce with U.S. rivals, Russia and China. Carl Baker of the security think tank Pacific Forum in Hawaii tells VOA's Victor Beatty that this is just another example of the off-the-cuff remarks by the Philippines' new leader that requires some clarification from his deputies.
Subsequent to Duterte's statement, Foreign Affairs Secretary Perfecto Yase said, well, I think this refers to no more joint patrols, which is something that Duterte had said, a couple weeks back, that there would be no joint patrols beyond the territorial waters of the Philippines. And then the National Security Advisor, Esperon, said, well, I think what he meant was this is the last exercise for 2016. So clearly his own cabinet doesn't really understand what's going on or what it means. So, I think there's a lot of confusion, and a lot of that confusion is being created by Duterte, who refuses to follow a script, who refuses to pay attention to advisors and just kind of talks off the cuff.
Earlier this week, he said he would visit Russia and China later this year to chart an independent foreign policy, open alliances with two powers with historic rivalries with the U.S. Is this a problem?
It's not a problem for the Philippines, I think, because what the Philippines is trying to do, I think, and this is the broader gist, I think, of what Duterte is moving toward, and that is to demonstrate that the Philippines has a more independent foreign policy under his presidency than it did under the Aquino presidency, because the perception had become that the Philippines was completely dependent on the United States, and he wants to assert the fact that the Philippines can defend itself and will take measures to make themselves more independent.
Mr. Duterte, of course, earlier said that he was going to ask that U.S. Special Forces be moved from the country's south. Is that something that's moving forward, to your knowledge?
It was a statement made by Duterte, and then the defense minister came back and said, well, that's not really what was meant, and there has been no directive to actually remove those people from the Philippines. And honestly, I haven't heard any more in the past 2 weeks about what's happened, but my understanding is that, again, it was off-the-cuff comment, and it was not intended as it was interpreted by the media, really. It's going to be a painful process because this seems to be a continuing problem with Duterte.
Carl Baker says that this all appears related to Manila's effort to reach out to China in the wake of the July ruling by the Permanent Court of Arbitration, which invalidated Beijing's claim of sovereignty to almost all of the South China Sea. He said the apparent slowing of construction on the disputed Scarborough Shoal is being taken by Manila as a sign that more progress can be made by befriending rather than confronting the Chinese. It's time for us to check out what's trending online. And to do that, our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, is right here in our studio with what's buzzing on the web. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim. Let's start with sports news. Aren't you glad?
Yes.
When it comes to having a good day as a fan, it's going to be hard to beat Dave Johnson. He was at Ryder Cup practice on Thursday in Minnesota, and it's a biannual men's golf competition between teams from Europe and the United States. After a few pros from Team Europe failed to sink a putt, Johnson yelled from the crowd that even he could make the shot. So three professional golfers called in from the crowd to prove it, and guess what happened?
He did it.
And there are videos to prove it on social media. I mean, if it didn't happen on social media, did it even really happen?
Right. If a tree falls in the forest, is there any sound?
We have to know it. British golfer Rory McIlroy was one of the pros that invited Johnson to the field and posted a video of him making the putt. He captioned it, "Has the Ryder Cup started already?" Nearly 9,000 people shared that clip, yours truly included.
Well, I'm going to have to include that on my weekly podcast called The Game Room.
Absolutely.
Be sure and download that next week. That's probably a bigger moment for him than anybody winning a major tournament. Well, let's move on to something else that's been all over social media. Libertarian presidential candidate Gary Johnson has apparently made another gaffe. What's that all about?
So this is something that happened during an MSNBC town hall Wednesday night. He was asked to name his favorite foreign leader and was unable to come up with an answer. But I think maybe what made it worse is that he actually said, "I am having an Aleppo moment," referring to the time when he was asked a question about Aleppo, and he said, "What is Aleppo?" Mm. Some people are aghast that a presidential hopeful cannot name a foreign leader that he admires. And this is how Johnson came back. He tweeted, "It's been almost 24 hours, and I still can't come up with a foreign leader I look up to." That's all for me today. Jim?
Well, I guess he has time between now and the election on November 8th
to come up with one.
Yes. Thank you for the wrap-up, G. You can follow both of us on Twitter at our International Edition stream, at @VOA_IE. Also, through our individual accounts. I'm at VOA Stevenson. She's at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, India launches strikes against suspected militants in Pakistan. Controversial warlord under fire over Afghan peace deal. Bangladesh will not attend South Asian regional summit in Pakistan. Myanmar leader Suu Kyi returns to capital after illness. Underground pipeline of cash and goods feeds North Korea's new capitalists. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and a whole lot more at the voanews.com website and through your smartphone on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. A terrible commuter train accident happened during the height of the morning rush hour Thursday in New Jersey. At least one person is dead, 108 others injured, some critically, after a commuter train crashed into a busy rail station in Hoboken, New Jersey. Hoboken City spokesman Juan Meli told VOA that the train derailed and plowed through the platform during the morning rush hour. The train came to a stop in a covered area between an indoor waiting area on the platform and it caused the collapse of a section of the metal roof. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said the train entered the station at much too high a rate of speed and crashed into all of the barriers before coming to a halt.
The engineer who was operating the train was also critically injured. He is at a local hospital and cooperating with law enforcement officials in the investigation.
Christie declined to offer specifics about the cause of the crash, but believes that it's nothing more than a tragic accident. International Edition host Sarah Williams spoke with correspondent Ramon Taylor just outside the train terminal.
I'm actually about two blocks away from the scene of the crash at this point. This is as close as they've allowed reporters to be. We're all corralled here waiting for updates really on the latest of those injured, how many fatalities there are. a lot of unknowns at this point. We just know that the numbers are in the very high dozens of those that are injured and potentially more than one fatality.
Is it known at all what caused this?
No, there. At this point, we know that the train didn't stop and it was going at a very high speed. So what was whether this was accidental on the part of the engineer or whether some sort of accident happened either purposely, we don't know. The engineer, as we know, has been evacuated, headed toward the hospital. He's at the hospital right now, but we don't have any sort of answers on that, and investigators are trying to get to the bottom of that.
Now, I guess this happened during the commuter time this morning. I mean, Hoboken is a pretty bustling, popular suburb of New York City.
It really is. Hoboken, after Newark, is really a giant hub for the citizens of New Jersey, especially those that commute to New York City. 60,000 plus commuters travel both ways every day to the city. And this happened right at rush hour. So you can imagine just a high density time, 8:45 this morning, a train traveling from Spring Valley. And again, we heard that it didn't stop. We know that potentially if there are more than one fatality, it might be the case that it might be a mixture of those that were on the train when it happened and possibly inside the station as well, because we know that the train actually slammed past the ticket turnstiles and into the station, into cement beams, causing the roof to partially collapse. So we're worried not just about those that were on the train, but those that were in the station as well.
VOA's Ramon Taylor at the commuter train terminal in Hoboken, New Jersey, the scene of the early morning crash. The United Nations is calling for the immediate medical evacuation of hundreds of wounded people from rebel-held eastern Aleppo in northern Syria, which has been under intense aerial bombardment by government and Russian forces for days. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The critical situation in Aleppo has overshadowed this week's deliberations of the International Syria Support Group's Humanitarian Access Task Force. The situation of hundreds of thousands of civilians trapped in 18 besieged areas in Syria remains an ongoing concern. But UN Deputy Special Envoy for Syria, Ramzi Ezzeldin Ramzi, says the task force focused on the major threat to the civilian population posed by the extremely heavy aerial bombardment of eastern Aleppo. He says the task force also criticized the indiscriminate shelling in government-controlled western Aleppo.
The bombing must stop. Civilians must be protected, and the cessation of hostilities must be restored.
Ramzi says the medical situation is particularly dire. He notes many hospitals have been damaged by airstrikes and medical supplies in this city, which has been without international aid for 3 months, are dwindling.
It is estimated that as many as 600 wounded cannot be provided with adequate treatment. Just yesterday, two of the remaining eight hospitals in Aleppo were reportedly hit by shelling, taking them out of service. There are now no more than 35 doctors covering a population of at least 275,000.
Ramzi says it is vital to start medical evacuations of the wounded as soon as possible. In addition, he says food stocks in eastern Aleppo are running low. He says 14,000 rations remain, enough for only one quarter of the population. He says constant heavy bombardment of this northern Syrian city has damaged and destroyed much of the basic infrastructure, causing a severe shortage of water and electricity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. Congress has voted to override President Barack Obama's veto of a bill that would allow lawsuits against Saudi Arabia for the terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. As VOA's Michael Bowman reports, Wednesday's tallies in both houses of Congress were overwhelming, and it also marked the first time an Obama veto has been overturned.
15 years after 9/11, lawmakers acted decisively to permit lawsuits against foreign entities that sponsor terrorism on U.S. soil. The bill was championed by those who lost loved ones on 9/11.
These families will never get back their loved ones. But they deserve justice and a day in court.
The Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act will send a strong message to those who sponsor terrorist attacks on American soil, including foreign governments, will answer to those victims and pay for the death and destruction that they cause.
In opposing the measure, the White House argued it endangers Americans abroad by undermining the concept of sovereign immunity.
The United States of America is more deeply engaged in more countries around the world than any other country in the world. So carving out additional exceptions to sovereign immunity puts the United States at greater risk than any other country in the world.
But many of the president's top allies on Capitol Hill were unswayed.
The risk of shielding the perpetrators of terrorism from justice outweighs the risks on how other countries might respond to and perhaps compromise U.S. interests.
15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 were Saudis. Victims' families have long believed that Saudi elements aided the hijackers. However, Saudi Arabia has long denied any role in the 9/11 attacks and warned of repercussions from the bill. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
Now that you've heard the story, we invite you to go to voanews.com for video of this story. You can actually see it. And also follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This is VOA's International Edition. There's a new movie out. It's directed by Tim Burton, and it stars Iva Green and Samuel L. Jackson, and it follows the fantastic adventures of a 16-year-old boy and a group of, quote, peculiar children. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about the film titled Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children.
There's a new world coming.
My dad said that everything had already been discovered.
Not everything, Jake.
Jacob, or Jake Portman, used to listen to his grandfather Abraham's stories about living in a special orphanage. Jake doubts the stories are real until he visits his dying grandfather and sees a strange, invisible monster with tentacle-like tongues attacking the old man. Abraham tells Jake to find the bird in the loop on the other side of the old man's grave in September 1940 and tell them what happened. No one believes Jake, played in the film by Asa Butterfield, but his psychiatrist suggests that Jake visit Wales, where his grandfather's orphanage was located. It's there that Jake meets Emma Bloom, played by Ella Purnell. Emma and an invisible boy named Millard Nillings take Jake to Miss Peregrine's orphanage. It's there that his adventures really begin. At the film's premiere, director Tim Burton said he was attracted to the story because it was told partially through narrative and partially through vernacular photographs.
Well, it's just, you know, I actually loved it before I even read it because I liked all the old photographs because I collect photographs. And it's something about the sort of weirdness and the sort of poetry and haunted quality seeing old photographs that I really appreciate. And also the feelings of peculiarities and, you know, feeling certain ways as a teenager and family and what's real and what's fantasy. All those themes were very, you know, all in the book.
Miss Peregrine tells Jake that she is an Imbrin who can create time loops. All the children in her orphanage are reliving the same 24-hour period to protect them. She says that creatures called hologasts, like the one that killed Jake's grandfather, are a threat to all Imbrin-run orphanages. But Jake, like his grandfather, can see them and stop them. Ella Purnell says that though this story is set in the World War II era, its issues resonate with today's young people.
for me, it was like, we need this more than ever now, and you know, social media and everything coming up, and for children, for teenagers, it's at that weird age. You're not a kid anymore, you're not an adult, you're trying to find your place, your way in the world, and it's hard with all the pressure that's on, you know, by society. And I think that actually watching a movie like this, which says to you, do you know what? It's okay to be weird, it's okay to be different, it's okay to, like, not fit in. And what is often perceived as a weakness should be seen, it should be used as a strength. And I think that's important to see.
Ava Green, known to many fans for the dark Victorian horror drama Penny Dreadful, plays Miss Peregrine. She says that having a cast mostly made of children brought a freshness to the film.
To tell you the truth, I was a bit nervous at the beginning, to work with all these children. And actually, they were so beautiful and, I love watching children because they have some grace. You know, they don't act, they just are, and it was just a great inspiration.
Oscar nominee Samuel L. Jackson plays Mr. Baron, the leader of the Whites, undead humans who evolved from hollow ghasts and hunt and kill peculiar children. Oscar winner Judi Dench stars as Miss Avocet, who runs another orphanage for peculiar children. Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children is rated PG-13. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Nothing peculiar about listening to International Edition. We're glad you did. You can always find us at voanews.com and online. Follow us on Facebook at VOA Now and on Twitter at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Carl Starling. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for listening and have a super day ahead.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is providing more than $181 million in additional humanitarian assistance for the Iraqi people to address critical humanitarian needs, including those expected to occur with Iraq's planned military offensive to liberate Mosul from Daesh occupation. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced this new funding September 14th, bringing U.S. humanitarian assistance for Iraqis to nearly $1.1 billion since fiscal year 2014. The United States remains committed to supporting the government of Iraq, including the Kurdistan Regional Government, in their response to the humanitarian crisis, as well as supporting the Iraqi people during their time of need. The United Nations anticipates the upcoming offensive could result in the displacement of more than 1 million people from Mosul and surrounding areas, exacerbating an already dire crisis that has left an estimated 10 million people, nearly a third of the country's population, in need of humanitarian assistance, and more than 3.3 million Iraqis displaced inside their own country as a consequence of Daesh's brutality. With this additional funding to international and non-governmental humanitarian organizations, the U.S. government reaffirms its commitment to support Iraq and provide assistance to displaced and conflict-affected Iraqis. The new funding enables the prepositioning of emergency food assistance and basic relief items to displaced Iraqis in preparation for the Mosul campaign. This money funds essential water, sanitation, and hygiene services that will provide displaced Iraqis with safe drinking water, clean latrines, and shower facilities. In addition to the funding to support Mosul preparedness, U.S. funding will support UNHCR and other agencies' efforts to provide assistance to the estimated 230,000 Iraqi refugees in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, and Turkey, including shelter, cash assistance, protection, and other forms of assistance. It will also support ongoing operations in Iraq to provide for the humanitarian needs of those already displaced by the conflict with Daesh, including livelihood support and social cohesion efforts, education, cash assistance, and protection monitoring services. The U.S. encourages other donors to follow our recent announcements with their own commitments to provide timely additional assistance for Iraqis, including for the forthcoming needs for Mosul, as well as for other global crises.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.